Support for the National Raiders series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Author Peter Matheson died in 2014. During his lifetime, he wrote over 30 books. He's well known for his nonfiction like The Snow Leopard, which traces his journey to the Tibetan Plateau in the Himalayas. He also wrote fiction with novels like At Play in the Fields of the Lord, The Watson Trilogy, and Far Tortuga. Peter's final book was the 2014 novel In Paradise. His official biography, called True Nature, is currently being written and is scheduled to be published by Knopf Pantheon in 2022. Peter visited Traverse City in 2010 and talked with me on the stage at the City Opera House. I asked him how he got the idea to write his book In the Spirit of Crazy Horse about American Indian activist Leonard Peltier.
I was doing another series of articles on Indian people and on their problems around the country, all over the place, the West and Cherokee and the East and Florida, all over. And I kept hearing about this guy called Leonard Peltier, and especially from there's an Indian spiritual leader out in Santa Barbara. He's called Archie Fire Lame Deer. He's actually, his father was a very, very well-known medicine man. And Archie, he's a Lakota, but he works out there. His wife is a Chumash, Indian from California. So he was living there, and he told me about Leonard. He was just up the coast. He'd been put in this prison, Lompoc, or Santa Maria. I think it was Lompoc. So he told me about the case, so I looked into it. And then I was doing a job in the Black Hills, talking about Indian people who were being impacted by uranium tailings piles. And there was this one village which was in terrible shape because of this pollution. The kids were playing on the pile, and they didn't know. What would they know? And coming through the Black Hills at that time was a guy called Bob Robidoux, who was one of the three originally indicted. And he'd just gotten out of prison. And he was up there seeing friends and stuff. And he took me down to the scene of the shootout on Pine Ridge. And we really worked through it step by step. And by the end of the day, I said, it's ridiculous. They could not have. It's impossible to have, you know, established this case, proven it. So then I got interested. There's a guy called Russell Means. He said, you ought to write the book because, you know, Indians, it takes us 2 years to get a pencil sharpened. And that is not true, but it was funny. But he said, and actually, you know, I wanted a young Indian writer to write about, because we have some very good Indian writers. And very good writers, you don't have to put the adjective on at all. They're great writers. Louise Erdrich, some of you may know, she's terrific. She's part Ojibwa, Anishinaabe, the same tribe. A different band up in Turtle Mountain, which is also where Leonard Peltier comes from. Leonard Peltier on Turtle Mountain, yeah. So that's kind of how it came about.
And then what happened when the book was published? Because
when it was published, I and my publisher were sued by Governor William Janklow of South Dakota. Janklow sued us for $24 million. And then an FBI agent named David Price, a notorious, oh, I better not say that, he'll sue me again. But the FBI came in with a suit for $25 million. And these guys pretended they weren't working together, but we established they were. And they just wanted to shut me up and see what they could do to the Viking Press as well. That's Viking Penguin, I mean, they're a very distinguished publisher. And so it was a $49 million case. And apparently it's the longest libel case in American history. But we won after. A judge, Patricia Murphy in Minneapolis, I think that's the Eighth Circuit, the higher court, appellate court. And she came in with a brilliant decision. I wish she'd come in with it a few years earlier, but, and it cost the publishers, or rather their insurance people, it cost them $3 million in legal fees. So think what it was. And all they were trying to do was keep it out of court. They said, if they get us in court, they're going to beat us. We can't fight them. We're running out of money. And who was paying for the other people? I was one of the ones paying with my taxes. You know, it's very annoying, subsidizing this government, which was not behaving well. Anyhow, I promised people this morning I would not get up on my soapbox, so I will do my very best not to do that. But I can't stay on this subject without getting on my soapbox.
Yeah, well, I remember buying that book, and you said 91?
91, yeah.
And going into the store and actually getting a hardcover copy and then trying to go back and buy a second one 3 weeks later, and it was gone. They had to remove it from the shelves.
Well, Viking didn't have to do that. We had kind of a spat over that because they removed the books before the judgment came down. Mm. They were running so scared. And they destroyed about 1,500 or 1,700 copies of the big fat book. And I said, you didn't have to do that. I said, I could have gotten those books out to Indian country. People could have used that. There's no sense in destroying it. You know, what are you doing? Then a very enterprising group of Indian people in Philadelphia, they were living there. They did a samizdat edition. They said, would you mind if we ran off our own copies? I said, go to it. They said, well, the publishers won't like it. I said, so they did. I have a copy still. I have one copy there. It wasn't very well put together, but it was okay.
Well, I don't know if it was about that time, but the first time that we met, I was watching you read from another book that, again, was a long journey for you, Killing Mr. Watson, and then eventually Shadow Country, which is three novels.
Yeah.
Tell us about, this is a story about your life as a novelist, which would be different than the Crazy Horse journey. What is the Watson trilogy about, and what kept you in it for 30 years?
Yeah. Overall, yeah, I didn't know that until I found my notes in 1978, and I thought, that was half my writing life, you know, really. I was in Florida. I was working with Indian people. And I was working for Audubon Magazine on environmental stuff. And I was in and out of Florida a lot. And I know it well, and I always liked it and liked working there. And this novel was going to be about the environment and what happened when Florida was first developed. I mean, they really walloped the whole state, really. And I remembered a story that my father had told me. He didn't know much about it. We were traveling up the west coast of Florida and the 10,000 islands, and it seems like 10,000, there's a great, great many, mainly mangrove islands, and some of them are a little bit higher, and most of those higher ones had Indian mounds, there were Indian villages on them in the old days. And he showed me on the marine chart, he said, this is Chatham River, and he said, there's a house up there. It's the only house in the Everglades. And it was owned by a man named Watson who was killed by his neighbors. And I was like, oh, killed by, what neighbors did he have? You know, I mean, there weren't any neighbors up there. Anyway, it stuck in my brain. How could this happen in a kind of a backcountry frontier area? A guy killed by his neighbors? I mean, what did he do? It's not like a turf war or anything. He's up there. So it just sort of stuck there. But I didn't do a thing about it. I was about 17 years old. And it only occurred to me a long time later. So I started looking into it, and there was quite a lot written about it. I got the news clippings, a woman named Stoneman Douglas, yeah, anyway, River of Grass, a great book about the Everglades. She had three pages about this guy, and every fact in her three pages was wrong. And this was not because she was a bad reporter. She wasn't. This is what people told her. This is what they thought she might want to hear if she was a writer. I guess they all think writers are all liars, you know. Anyway, they pumped her full of this malarkey. And a lot of them didn't know either. They were pretending, oh yeah, my father knew this guy. His name was Edgar Watson. Ah yeah, he knew Watson, you know, kind of thing. He'd give you the shirt off his back with one hand and stab you in the back with the other. There's all kinds of nonsense like that. I heard of a lot of it too. So she was just sort of fooled, but everybody else was too, but partly because they were lazy. They didn't do their homework. They took the accepted thing, and it's partly the family's fault. He had a very distinguished family in South Carolina, and also his daughter lived in Fort Myers. She was married to a very distinguished banker there, Walter Langford. He founded the First National Bank there. He was the guy that brought in the railroad. And she was, her name was Carrie Langford, but they would not talk to me. And I don't blame them. You know, in those days, he was killed in 1910. imagine what it was like to have your father killed. And they didn't fool around, because I read the sheriff's memoirs, and they took 33 bullets out of him. So it was a pretty decisive. It wasn't what you'd call offhand.
Was he a tyrant, a madman?
Was he a madman? No. I wouldn't write about him. The criminal mentality, by and large, is not very interesting, despite most of them, it's kind of a stunted look, and they really want to know how much space they're getting in the papers, you know. But Watson was a very interesting man. He was a farmer. He was a near genius farmer. He could grow stuff on those mangrove islands, and nobody knew how he did it. And he was on the run. Why he was down there was because he got messed up in northern Florida and then in Oklahoma. It turns out he is the guy they think. He was the only person ever taken to court for the murder of Belle Starr. Do you remember the famous outlaw woman, associate of Jesse James and people like that? Watson was in Oklahoma, and he was sent to Arkansas prison, but not for that. He was for horse theft, and he escaped from Arkansas penitentiary and made his way back to Florida. That actually is true. That did happen. And settled in this very remote, wild place and tried to make a go of it. And he was so good that he really was doing okay. And then he bought a schooner, and he knew nothing about the sea. This guy taught himself to. And they had these sort of small schooners, and they sailed them single-handed sometimes. And that's very complicated if you know about sailing boats. I mean, these are fairly good-sized cargo boats. And he had his own boat. He became Captain E.J. Watson. Hmm. Yeah, and he was everybody liked him. He's a great storyteller.
Until they killed him.
What?
They liked him until they shot him.
I think they liked him even when they killed him. But and he had three wives, not all at the same time. And he didn't kill any of them, and he had about seven children with them. And other ladies also liked him, and he had several children out of wedlock, as they say. He was a very colorful guy, and he also had a terrible temper, and he was a bad drinker. He was a bad drinker, and when he was drinking, watch out. But he comes, all the things we read in the paper all the time, you know, if a kid gets abused and beaten terribly in childhood, it's apt to do serious damage in terms of them as an adult. And his father was famously a child beater, wife beater, everything. And they all had to run away. It got so bad. So Edgar Watson had a very, very dark childhood. And they all ran off to Florida. I went to see the family in South Carolina, too. These people, wow, they had these big plantations on the Edisto River. They were very successful plantation owners and stuff at the time. And Edgar's father was a black sheep, to put it mildly. And he didn't end up very well. But anyway, the family ran off to Florida. They couldn't bear with him.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Peter Matheson talks about his voyage to the Himalayas to write his book, The Snow Leopard.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with the late author, Peter Matheson. I've noticed, though, you've talked a lot about, you've been interested in people on the edge.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, Leonard he's been marginalized by the justice system to the edge of American society.
Yes, yeah.
Watson is a man who's lived on the edge, and I wanted to just figure out, listening to you, what it was, because the book, the novel, which is now one novel, Shadow Country, is amazing. It won the National Book Award in 2008, which is no mean feat. But here's a very complicated man. And you said something so interesting in an interview, that you love the humanity of these fellows, that you're not looking for the angels, I think, or something like that. You're looking for the real complex.
I'm looking for people who are living on the edge and they're having a hard time. And they're not just neurotic, you know. And I feel that city life, suburban life, and everything has been pretty well covered by some very, very good writers. And since that's where I came from, I knew about it, but I didn't want to write about it. In fact, I spent half my life escaping from it, you know, so why would I want to write? And I just like people who really have a tough go of it, really tough. And I even got fond of it, and I'll use that word because they do, I got fond of these rednecks who were living where he lived. They were pretty rough. I mean, the way they still saw things, even after the Civil Rights Act and everything, they were not good. But it was very tough for them. They were just being pushed off the map. They'd been there forever. And, you know, the tourists and winter people come down on the land and they buy it up, and these guys get pushed further and further out on the edge. And ironically, what they all say, now we know how the Indians felt. This is what's happening to us. And they're very, very angry at the government, and they should be, actually, the way they see it. You know, that's from their perspective, I really understand that. So somehow, despite my political leanings and my, you know, I got kind of fond of them despite their terrible racism, you know, that somehow they're trying and they're fighting hard, and this is the way where they were brought up, and they have these opinions which aren't very pretty to my thinking. But finally, you know, they took me in and they talked to me, and we had a funny episode. There was one very funny. I was in Miami at a book fair there, and the Miami Herald said, "We hear you're in town. We want to do a picture feature of you. We'll take you over to Chokoloskee." Chokoloskee is a little tiny village just at the edge of the Everglades National Park, near Everglade. And that's where he was killed, actually, not on his own property. And by the way, he was killed for a series of killings which certainly did occur on his property, but he didn't do it. Now, he may have known about it, but he didn't do it. Anyhow, I said, "Well, okay, how long is he?" He said, "Well, we're going to drive over." Well, that's all the way across Florida. I said, "That's a pretty long drive, and I'm doing things here, you know." They said, "Yeah, but you got to do it. We're going to really feature this thing, and we're going to bring a photographer along, that kind of thing." And they did. And I met the photographer. He was a very lively, funny, smart young guy. But he was black. I said, "You guys have been in Chokoloskee before?" You know, and this kid was lively. I mean, he was funny. You could see right away. I mean, he was a very, very bright guy. But I think he came from one of the islands. He didn't know about American thing. They didn't have that problem where he came from. And I didn't want to tell him. I mean, I didn't want to set him up, you know. So he went into the old post office store museum there, and he really got the freeze. And he was just being friendly and natural. And then they came up to me and said, "We want you to run for the restaurant." And I interpreted that to mean, "We want you to come to lunch over at the restaurant." The restaurant being a very modest restaurant indeed. But I said, "Yeah, all right." I said, "That's very kind of you." And I said, "There'll be three of us." And they swallowed it, and he came with us. And he was, by this time, poor guy, was really so stiff. He didn't know what was happening. And I was angry about that, but I sat through it. And during this lunch, this terrible lunch, I mean, it actually was quite a good lunch. But two different guys came up to me. And I said, "Oh." Because a lot of these people didn't like me either. They don't come out too well in my book. And the first guy and the second guy, almost the same. He came up and said, "You know that book you wrote?" I said, I do. "No, I know about it." He says, "Well, You got it about right. And he walks off. He doesn't say, "Welcome to Chokoloskee," or "I hope you enjoyed your lunch." It was just that terse little, "You got it right." And another guy came up and did the same thing. And I said, "Why are they doing this? This is not what they're really trying to get across to me." And I think what they're really saying is, "It could have been worse." "You could have told more, and you didn't, thank you, you know, we're out of here." But it was cold.
Yeah. That's funny. You know, it's interesting. You know, I don't know if you just know this, but
you basically said, I really grew fond of a group of guys who a lot of society wouldn't find redeemable, and that's because I think you're an artist, as opposed to a politician who would try to figure out how it is those guys could either be beaten or co-opted. You see what I mean? I mean, you found something within their person, their humanity, that you thought was interesting. And so much today, when we even in our printed matter, in the books you read, it's all about one side trying to kill the other, or just shaming. Here's what it is: shaming. People wagging their finger and saying, "Shame on you! Shame on you!" We don't learn anything. Through that. I mean, I now have, you know, we all in this room have a different kind of understanding of this place, which is Chuckalusky, right? Because you went there and kept breathing and kept observing, as opposed to just wagging your finger saying, shame on you, you all people ought to be bulldozed into the sea.
No, they're people like us. I mean, they're just pushed into a corner and that.
But that's such a rare sentiment, though, these days.
Well, Watson himself, I had to get, because here's a guy who was, he didn't kill 55 people, which was the myth about him, but I couldn't separate him from about seven. he'd kill at least seven people. And so I'm dealing with a killer, and not a good guy here. But he had great virtues, he had certain things. But I had to get into him. He's still a human being. At one point, he was a little boy. And like we were boys, you know, once. I know that. So what happened to him? And he was very bright, obviously. He was very able. So you finally see that aspect of him. Where did his life go wrong? And was it how much was his responsibility? And once you do that, once you get inside a person like that, then you start seeing it from there.
Yeah.
Way, you know.
I want to ask you about, that's now the book Shadow Country. Earlier, you wrote a book called Snow Leopard. Well, there are three books out. For all of us in this room, I think there may be three books that we know best. Far Tortuga.
Not too many people know about Far Tortuga.
Who knows Far Tortuga? And then At Play in the Fields of the Lord, which I can't recommend enough. And the Snow Leopard. And the two things I would love you to do, at some point before you leave the stage, I'd love you to read just a paragraph from At Play in the Fields of the Lord in this edition right here, the end of the book. And talk for a moment about winning. You say in Snow Leopard, I win my life by losing it? Or what was the aphorism that you came up with? Or why don't you set up the book first about what is this journey you go on in the Himalayas? Where are you in your life when this happens?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was working out in Africa. I did three or four books on Africa. I love that. My wife actually was born in Africa. She was raised in Tanzania. So she was 19, and then she went to London, and then she came to America. You know, but before that, I was already going to Africa, and I was working in the Serengeti. And a lot of you, I'm sure, know the work of George Schaller. He's our most distinguished field biologist, really, and a great conservationist, and a terrific guy. And he was working there, too. He did a book called The Serengeti Lion. I think The Serengeti Lion is also nominated for a book award. I'm not sure. He's a good writer. He's one of the few scientists who's really a great writer, too. But he told me he was going up to the Himalayas. He wanted to study these blue sheep, which he was going to prove were goats. This is his theory. Why a guy would cross the Himalayas on foot to prove that a sheep was a goat, I don't know. But that's how science works, and I quite understand. He wanted to get this straight. Because it's not really just about that. It's defining the family, the characteristics that make a sheep and a goat. And I got very taken with it myself before I got through. But anyhow, he was going up there, and I said, oh my God, I would love to go to that place. And when this happened, I'm a Zen student now, but I wasn't then, I was just before. So I didn't have a Buddhist thing going then. Neither one of us talked about it. I mean, I had a family at home, little kids and stuff. But in this next period, my wife died, and I had become kind of a new Buddhist practitioner. And I got fascinated by the area. I was still in touch with George, where he was going. He was heading for a place called the Crystal Mountain, and a very famous Lama who lived there alone. And I signed on. I made arrangements as I could for my kids, and everything was fine. So that's how we had a pretty good hike. We walked 250 miles over the Himalaya. The Himalaya isn't kind of a wall of peaks. It turns out that behind that, you know, and it was a long way. It took us about 6 weeks or something to get to the Crystal Mountain. And the Crystal Mountain is in this unreal world. They don't know what country they're in. They're living in about the 11th century, really. Wild, wild, remote people. Terrific. Very nice people.
And you thought it would be a book of haiku at one point.
Yeah. Here's one of my notable failures. I speak with all the authority of failure. There's a wonderful book, a Japanese, by a Japanese teacher and poet called Basho, Master Basho. And it's called A Journey to the Far North. And his technique, he goes on this foot journey and various spots and springs and mountains all through northern Japan. And everywhere he went, he would make this wonderful description of what he was doing, very spare, very simple, very clear. And in between, he would write a little haiku poem. So all these haiku are there. Haiku are very, very short, very, they're wonderful poems. I thought, wow, what a great way to write a book. And I said, it'll suit the Himalaya and it'll suit my Buddhist practice, because I was a fervent new student then. And so I was, you know, and the paragraphs, they were going fine. The haiku went, I didn't think it was so good. So George Schaller, who's not a literary man, he's a good writer, but he's not a, you know, he hasn't read a lot of literature. Doesn't know about much about poetry or anything. And he's also very intense, and he was sort of eating up the food, and he was eating up the little few things he brought to read. He was using them up because we got stuck and delayed by rain over and over again. We'd long, miserable days in the tent with water coming down. And he ran out of things to do. And he sees me over there scribbling. He said, what are you doing? Is that your journal? I said, well, I got the journal too, but I'm writing these little poems called haiku. He said, what are haiku? So I told him what they were, and I gave him some, you know, a little bit of instruction about them. And I said, why don't you try them? You haven't got anything else. This is how things happen. George wrote three or four very beautiful haiku. And there are three or four haiku in my book by George Schaller, but none by me. It just worked out that way. He just had a way of seeing. It's one reason I like being with him. He's a very intelligent guy.
So what the Snow Leopard becomes is that journal that you were keeping in the tent.
Yeah.
You write on October 14th. What year was this?
1973.
You know, these dreams do not seem to evaporate. Can I be dead? It is as if I had entered what Tibetans call the bardo, literally between two existences, a dreamlike hallucination that precedes reincarnation, not necessarily in human form. So this is some heavy thinking going into this journal in the wake of your wife's death. But
there's that. And everything was so clear there, and you're at altitude, you know. Your mind really...
You said earlier, when we were talking about, you felt you had moved into the realm of myth.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, we started off in southern Nepal, which is really like India. I mean, very, very, almost tropical. And warm rivers and buffalo and people in the fields and that kind of thing. And then we started to move north, up over the first part of the mountains. And every little way we went, time went backwards. You felt you were not only walking north and higher, but you were walking back in time. It was a very powerful sensation. The way that people were, the way they were dressed, the way they furrowed the fields, everything about it had gotten more and more. It really was like walking back into a fairy tale. And we went way up. We had to go to 19,000 feet. That's a long way to go across the last pass to where we were going. And horrible. I was frozen up there. I remember that. Bad news. But at a certain point, and I wasn't very far in there either, and I turned to Schaller and I said, if I can't get a good book out of this, I ought to be taken out and shot. And I really meant it. It was just so powerful and so beautiful. And it all panned out. We got up. We did not see the snow leopard. Schaller, we went out a different route. He went a different way, and I went a little bit earlier because of my kids at home. And he saw one snow leopard going out, but otherwise he didn't
see
it.
Well, he was there.
But it was right there. We saw the fingerprints, the footprints, and we heard them. We knew they were right there. They were seeing us. We weren't seeing them.
Right, but that wasn't the point, though. The journey was the point, right? I mean, when you get to Crystal Mountain, there's a llama there who's crippled. Do I have that?
Yeah,
right?
A totally crippled llama, just dressed in kind of leather rags and drinking Tibetan tea. But he's on this rock ledge backed up into a mountain, and all he can see is the Crystal Mountain, which is this extraordinary glacier mountain, like a ship. Right through that, blue sky, just sailing away there. And all around the rivers below, all full of ice, and they're black and ice and white, and really a mind-blowing scene, But it would be nice to be able to leave home once in a while, and he had no way of, you'd need a helicopter to get him out of there, because there was no way. He couldn't walk the trail. He was hopelessly crippled. And so he sits there on that ledge and meditates and thinks. And finally, I or somebody got up the nerve to say, well, how is it, living like this, as simply as this? And he said, oh, it's wonderful, especially when you have no choice. So that was a great Zen teaching right there. So, yeah, he was good.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Peter Matheson reads from his books At Play in the Fields of the Lord and Far Tortuga.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to my conversation with Peter Matheson.
At Play in the Fields of the Lord is about a group of missionaries who go to South America, and all kinds of drama ensues. The protagonist or the hero or the who is he in that novel? Moon.
I call him Lewis Moon.
Lewis Moon.
Yeah.
Lewis has a similar kind of journey by the end of that novel, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. Lewis Moon is in the novel. He's Cheyenne Indian, coming from kind of a rough background and everything. And he's a soldier of fortune, and he's going into the jungle with his partner, Wolfie. And they have this old plane, and they're up for anything people want them to do, pretty much. They're not a savory pair. And he's very, very, antisocial. He's kind of laconic. But it doesn't matter how he developed was. I remember kind of. One was when I was working out west. There was a young Navajo guy. And I picked him up somewhere in West Texas or certainly in New Mexico. And I dropped him off somewhere in Arizona at a very mysterious destination. We were just going along the road, and he went pop, pop, knocked on the window with his knuckle, and he got out and just walked away across the desert. I mean, there was nothing there whatsoever. And he hadn't said one word to me. I could not get, white people are so eager to make contact and be liked, And so I went through all that stuff first, and I gave up on him completely because he was just like that. And I know now, after that, I worked with Navajo people, and they live out there around Big Mountain, and they really are very, very far from anywhere. It's a pure culture out there. And they're very shy. They're very shy by the fact that they do not speak English, and that, you know, and they don't want to lose their dignity. I don't blame them. So he just shut up, which is, I wish we could all learn that. When in doubt, shut up. That's what he did. But I was struck by that stoicism and that whatever. So he struck me. Then I was going up the river, the Amazon, in this freighter, and we stopped at Belém at the mouth of the river.
Where did you catch the freighter, just so it's interesting, I think?
Oh, I caught the freighter in Brooklyn, New York.
Could anyone do that, just get on the freighter in Brooklyn and go up the Amazon, or how, I mean?
Well, for young writers, boy, oh boy, you ought to look into it. I mean, it's really, these freighters, well, they go around the world. And if you're writing a book and you're not in a big hurry, they're dropping off cargo everywhere. One of our cargoes was Christmas trees for the Amazon market, you know. We went everywhere. We went to Bermuda, and then we went to the Barbados, and we went to this and this and this. And what did you ask me?
I think the boat is leaving.
Oh, yeah. Where did Lewis Moon come from?
Yeah.
In Belém, I was out at a bar, as a young fellow will do, drinking, and I ran into a guy, a French-Canadian guy, and he was simply but humbly dressed, but clean and everything, and very self-respecting. And we got talking, and I said, well, what are you doing here? He said, I'm just going around. I said, where are you staying? He said, I'm not staying anywhere. I have everything right with me. And he did. He had this little box, a little leather case, and he had in there everything he needed. He had a razor. The razor was cut in half. And it turned out this guy, he started telling his story. And his story was, he was a merchant seaman, and he was on a ship north of Venezuela in kind of rough times. He was out securing the cargo, putting another cable on the cargo or something to hold things in place. And I don't know what happened, but he went over the side. Nobody saw him go. And he was out there in the ocean, and I don't know how long, but he was out there a long time. And he just by a miracle, a fishing boat came along before he drowned or went under. He was a strong swimmer, I hope. But anyway, he made it. When he got to land and he got back to where he could communicate, he wrote a letter to his wife. And he said, I've learned something about life. And he said, goodbye. You can have the house. You can have our little savings, whatever they were. It's all yours. I'm leaving everything to you. And he wrote a note to that effect. He never went home again. And all he does is wander around, this kind of pilgrim. And he's seen wonderful stuff. I mean, he really has. But he's not writing about it. He's not trying to make it into a... He's not like me. If I can't get a good book out of this, I ought to be shot. He's more like a Buddhist, wandering Buddhist mendicant, you know, kind of thing going around. But I was very taken with him. I was very impressed by him. I didn't love him, but he was something about him. Anyway, he was stuck in my brain, and the young Navajo. And the third person is me. Is, you know, your protagonist is almost always quite a lot of yourself in there. You've got to. That's where you're coming out of.
That's the novel that really kind of, you said, catapulted you. You'd written three novels before that.
Yeah, I wrote three early novels.
Right.
Of no distinction.
Well, and that's what you think.
But, that's what I think.
Yeah. And then, but
a lot of short stories too. Yeah.
And then that play in the Fields of the Lord comes out, and it's really still a very popular book among general readers and colleges and universities. I think it's again because it's about a spiritual journey.
Yeah, it is.
That Lewis is on this path.
Yeah. He doesn't know he is. He's a tough, kind of unpleasant guy. And but they get an assignment in this terrible old frontier town out on the rivers, and there's an indigenous tribe there that's unruly. They're getting in the way of the oil and rubber development when people want to make an honest dollar. And so mainly they're under instructions to bomb the hell out of this Indian communities. And they have this old beat-up airplane, and the sign on the airplane is "Small Wars and Demolition." And that's kind of who they are. But Moon has this kind of a mystical experience under drugs, under a very, very powerful narcotic drug down there called ayahuasca or yagi. And he has this extraordinary vision. And he goes out to the airship and he leaves his partner behind. He goes up and he just flies more or less out there until the plane is out of gas. And the missionary is trying to get him on the radio, you know, where are you? And he said, you're running out of gas. You must be running. And he said, I'm at play in the fields of the Lord. He was just really tripping out there. Couldn't power. But finally, the time comes when he has to parachute. The plane does run out. And he's just parachuting down into this wild jungle. But he'd seen a village clearing, I guess. I've forgotten. But these Indians decide not to kill him. They take him in. And he's in a way transformed. He's trying to help them. He tries to save them from what he knows is coming from mm-hmm. civilization. So it's sort of that. And then he has this long, long river journey at the end. He doesn't know where he is. He's just completely lost. And he's not on drugs anymore. But he's free. He's utterly failed at what he tried to do.
Would you mind reading the last few passages after the space break there? I think it'd be a real treat.
You're nice to say so.
It's the very end of the novel.
Yeah, he's all by himself now, and he's run out of food. He's in a canoe. The Indians were destroyed, by the way. He failed in his mission. So he's drifted down, and he doesn't know where he is. He's in the Amazon river system somewhere, but where he doesn't know. At morning, the wind was cold again and brought a brown chop to the river. The river was wide and slow, without tight bends or rapids. The land had flattened, and great tracts of flooded savanna broke the ramparts of the rainforest. In the shelter of the drift rack, a mud beach had been strained from the brown water. All that day, he squatted on this scrap of earth, mouth open, a dead fish beside him on the strand, lone bony trees across the reaches of pale swamp, black circling birds, a gaunt cormorant on the snag of a drowned tree, a dead snake belly up in the driven water. No sign of man. Under the raining banks, unknown antediluvians gasped and swirled. He felt bereft of what he did not know. He was neither white nor Indian, man nor animal, but some mute, naked strand of protoplasm. He groaned with the ache of his own transience under this sky, as if, breathing too deeply, he might rise on the wind as lightly as a seed, without control or intimation of his fate. He was the nameless beetle, probing the pores of his own toe. He twitched in the wind like the dull scale that loosened on the flank of the rotting fish. His was the bald eye of the vulture, forming its halo over the mute landscape. And far beneath, he saw the solitary man on the humble mud. That was him. On every side, there stretched away a vast world without a sun. The savanna was beaten flat by wind and rain, and the sky was so huge that the weight of the whole hemisphere oppressed him. He did not know within 1,000 miles where he might be, nor on what river, nor in what country. How close, how far, stood the nearest being under the same sky. A cold sun loomed through the pall and peered at him. He raised both arms to the sun. The sun withdrew. He drifted eastward. The sky turned heavily, battered by wind. He drifted eastward, eastward, past long sandbars, bare of tracks. He thought, am I the first man on the earth? Am I the last? On an island shared with swift white birds, he trapped some small fish in a pool. He clutched the live quicksilver things, triumphant. The pool reflected his hunched form against the sky. In a face bare with privation, the wide eyes were clear, and behind the face, the clouds of heaven rolled majestically across the world. At noon, the sun returned again, resplendent. He entered its sparkle on the water and opened his mouth and drank. The flood was mineral and cold as a prairie river. It coursed his throat, his lungs, the inside of his skin. It bathed his heart. He let the water pour across him, wash in and out of his clean mouth. He rolled in the warm shallows like an otter and washed his skin with sand. He assembled a fire of dry, precious sticks, coaxing a small trance flame with a makeshift drill. The sun flowed softly in his hands. Clean as the silver driftwood, strong as wind, he broiled the brilliant fish on sticks, exultant. The wind was bright, laid naked to the sun and sky, and he felt himself open like a flower. Soon he slept. At dark, he built an enormous fire in the celebration of the only man beneath the eye of heaven. I'm very hesitant to tell you this little anecdote because it sounds very boastful and probably is, you know, but I've kidded myself into thinking. Anyhow, I'm going to tell you because it goes so much with that passage. Some of you know the work of William Styron. He's a very good American, great American novelist, really. Sophie's Choice and all those books, wonderful books. But he and I were old friends, and he wrote a book called The Confessions of Nat Turner. I'll bet you some of you have read that. It's another great book. And when he was working on that book, and I don't know what I was working on, but I was at home, he called me up one morning out of the blue. He's up in Connecticut. I'm out on the end of Long Island. And he said, you know, I'm just finishing the end of Nat Turner, and there's a river voyage, Nat all along, going down the river. And I just looked at it, playing the fears of the Lord. I hoped your passage wasn't as good as I remembered it. And he said, damn you, it was. And he banged it from me. But you know, for a writer, that's a very, very generous. Writers do not, generally speaking, do that. I was very touched by that, by the gesture.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
There's that sense, you know, Lewis has of opening, of awakening, apprehension of his self, and his name Moon. There are a lot of metaphors and symbols you've talked about in this book. Your next book, I think, is Far Tortuga, or your next novel. Which
next
takes,
novel.
What, 13 years?
12 or 15 years after that play, yeah. And I was losing hope of being a novelist still, because I was doing all these books for The New Yorker, all these travel books, and social action, and starting up, and that kind of stuff. But I really thought of myself as a novelist, and I thought I'd copped out. It was so tempting to go to all these places on somebody else's dime, you know, and write about it, and write about things that I was very passionate about preserving wild places and protecting wild people. And I loved it, and I loved working with Indian people.
Just a couple sentences here. They're really almost passages or stanzas, as in a poem. Just to hear you, how you, because I've always wondered how you voice this novel. It's not like reading regular prose.
The book begins with the sunrise out to the east end of the island, and it comes up, and I say where the sun hits. Well, I'll just read a little bit of that. And it finally gets to the harbor where the ship is getting ready to sail, and you start getting to know the crew. But I established the style here. If you've ever seen a movie script, it's a little bit like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like camera directions. It just guides you through. All right, here's the beginning of the book. Daybreak. At Windward Passage, 400 miles due east, the sun is rising. Wind east-northeast, 38 knots, with gusts to 45, a gale. Black waves, wind-feathered. White birds, dark birds. The trade winds freshen at first light, and the sea rises in long ridges, rolling west. Sunrise at longitude 76, 19 degrees north latitude. Sunrise at longitude 77. Sunrise at the lesser Cayman Islands. Horizon rises from horizon. To the westward, Grand Cayman is gray. Its high cumulus, visible to migrant birds 100 miles away, is a gray pink. The sun coming hard around the world. The island rises from the sea, sinks, rises, holds. Sunrise at Old Isaacs, and I put in parentheses, Isaac Borden, deserter, first known settler, dates obscure. The sun kindles the thatch of hip-roofed cottages, built at East End since early days. Sand road, white pickets, periwinkle, white sand yards, bordered with pink conchs. Cock crow. Wind and cloud sail down the island east to west. A sweet warm wind comes, sucking faint damp from the parched cactus and palmetto. Sunrise and trackless alley land. New light strikes the blue spines of an iguana. Its chewing slows. Starting from its hole, a land crab, you know crabs do, a land crab pauses, then withdraws. A grain of earth rolls down into the hole. Well, anyway, you get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Sunrise at Savannah, a lone dog on the road, stiff-legged, poinsettia and jasmine, low white walls. And finally, it comes to the harbor. And I'll give you about three lines. So these guys, they're getting the boat ready, and the captain's already on the deck. And an old man on the quay, he says to one of the crewmen, oh no, the crewman says to him, "Fair wind for the quays, then, Cap'n Teddy. You sailing late, Byron? Get more wind and turtle in the Maytime." A guy comes along, he's moving an oil drum, and this sailor tries to help him. "What say, man? Easy, man. I'll give you a hand there with that drum." "Dad, okay, I got this by myself. Long as you don't squish that sailor in the boat, Speedy doing fine." "You call that a sailor? That old V-man. What say, V-man?" V-man is an alcoholic fellow. And the drunk guy looks up and he sees the guy rolling the drum. "Black Honduran. How that go, V-man?" "Never mind, man. He don't bother me. Speedy doing fine. I'm fueled up, V-man."
Wow, that's really fat. I mean, that.
That was Peter Matheson talking with Doug Stanton. Peter Matheson died in 2014. His final novel was In Paradise. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.